Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Hey fam, it's me, Amara. Welcome to the Translash Podcast, a show where we tell trans stories to save trans lives. April is Autism Acceptance Month, and there's so much neurodiversity within the trans community. In fact, one large 2020 study showed that trans and gender nonconforming people are 3 to 6 times more likely to be autistic than cis people. And despite the fact that these numbers are used to discredit the very idea of transness by the anti-trans hate machine, there are critical intersections at being both neurodivergent and trans that are critical to unpack. That's why today I wanted to explore what autism is, what it looks like to be trans and autistic, and to celebrate the neurodiversity within our community. And there's no better person to do this with than the groundbreaking social psychologist and author of Unmasking Autism, Dr. Devin Price, who's changed the game in our understanding of what it means to be autistic and trans.
If we don't see autism as a pathology, as something wrong with someone, then we don't necessarily need to believe that it needs to be diagnosed, right? Like, I also self-diagnosed my transness.
But before we get to that absolutely riveting conversation, I'm so excited to announce that the Translash Podcast has been nominated for a Webby Award. Can you hear the applause and the balloons that are falling down all around me? We were nominated in the podcast interview / talk show category for our episode Trans Voices on Gaza. And I couldn't be prouder of that episode. We spent a lot of time on it and worked really hard to get it right. So please go and vote using the link in the episode description. We really appreciate the support and would love to actually take home a Webby since we've been nominated 3 times. So with that, and our urging you to go cast your vote for us, let's start it as always with some trans joy. So often, autistic people are reduced solely to their autism. But there are so many brilliant autistic writers, thinkers, and artists in our communities. Take Ceri Jarrell Johnson. He's an award-winning poet, writer, and spiritualist. His time traveling and deeply embodied work has appeared in publications like The New York Times, The Yale Review, and Granta, just to name a few. He's also an award-winning author. His work, Slingshot, which explores Black sexual and gender deviance and the value of manhood, was awarded a 2020 Lambda Literary Award in Gay Fiction. Ceri's second book, Watch Night, came out just this past February and has already won a James Laughlin Award. He has also been reading tarot for over 22 years and offers divination and education services. Here's Ceri to tell us more about how autism shapes his creative process.
My poetry is an expression of my desire for internal rules. But I know that that is like an autism thing for me where it's like, yeah, I like that order. Like, I like that structure. Like, I like that tradition. I like that rigor. I like those caveats. I like those limits, right? Those limited options in which creativity can flourish. And I think poetry lives in the mouth, you know, like it is like there is a poem that lives on the page and there's a poem that lives in the mouth. And, you know, they have to be negotiated. They're not the same thing. And even in formal poetry that can feel rigid, that negotiation is still happening. And so finding that is one of my special interests for sure. And also a very magical process.
Ceri Jarrell Johnson, you are trans joy.
You
Get ready for a thought-provoking conversation with social psychologist, author, and proud autistic person, Dr. Devin Price. Devin has been an influential figure in bridging academic research and accessible discourse on topics like neurodiversity, radical mental health, and queerness. He is the author of several books, including Unmasking Autism, The Power of Embracing Our Hidden Neurodiversity, and Laziness Does Not Exist. His most recent book, Unlearning Shame, came out just this past February. Devin's shorter writing has appeared in outlets like the Financial Times, Slate, Huffington Post, and on his popular Medium blog. On the academic side of things, Devin has published his research in places like the Journal of Experimental Social Psychology and the Journal of Positive Psychology. He currently works as an assistant professor at Loyola University Chicago's School of Continuing and Professional Studies. Devin, thank you so much for joining me.
Yeah, thank you for having me. Nice to meet you, Amara.
Nice to meet you. I first want to ground us in the definition of autism, because there are so many ways in which the term is thrown around. Sometimes people are saying it because they are referencing neurodivergence, or, you know, they are referencing some type of behavior which they believe to be antisocial. So I'm just wondering if we can just ground ourselves first into the definition of autism.
Yes, it's a great place to start because there is so much misinformation. And because autism is a really pervasive developmental disability that really touches every aspect of how a person processes information, socializes, how they respond to stimuli. It can even affect things like motor and muscle development and reaction times. So it is really, really hard to sum up. The best way of summing up that I've ever seen for all that autism is comes from a collective called the Autisticats, and they call autism essentially having a bottom-up processing style in a world that is really built for people who process in a very top-down fashion. So what I mean by that is most people who aren't autistic, they can run off of intuition pretty well when it comes to feeling out what somebody else is feeling, figuring out what the social norms are of a new space. If there's a ton of sound and movement and light and sensory information, like you're at a big party, non-autistic people generally know what to ignore and what's important to process and listen to and focus on. Whereas for autistic people, we're basically getting all of that information piecemeal, just all at the same level of intensity. And so that means we tend to process pretty slow. We tend to be really easily distracted and overwhelmed. And it also means we can't really take anything for granted. Like, I can't look at someone's face and know what emotion they're feeling. I have to look at every piece of their face and try to, in a bottom-up way, put together a good guess of what they're feeling. And that kind of explains a lot of the things that can seem unusual about autistic people, is that we're really bombarded with a lot of information that we have to process piece by piece really slowly.
And of course, there's a spectrum for autism, right? And can you just talk a little bit about that? Because that probably adds to the difficulty in determining what is autism and not, because there is a large spectrum, right?
Yeah, you know, autistic traits are human traits. It is hard to draw a firm line between what is autism and what's not, right? And so every little autistic trait exists on a total continuum from, let's say, special interests. So that's like really studying a topic really obsessively. There are some people who are autistic who have the one thing that they're obsessed with their whole life. And then there are some of us who hop around between different things we're fixated on. And of course, there are people who aren't autistic who get really fixated on a topic and can kind of relate to that in us. And the same thing's true of something like sensory issues. There are some of us who are super, super sensitive to sound, really can't barely leave the house because there's just so much stimuli out in the world. And then there are some of us at the complete opposite end of the spectrum who are sensory seekers, who want really loud stimulation and noise. And I think that's true for people in general. I tend to be of the point of view that we have more in common than we have apart, even though the struggles of being autistic in the world can be kind of distinct and profound. These traits really do vary so much for all of us. we really range a lot in, it used to be called like functioning level, and that's really way too simplified to talk about it, but how visible our autism is can really, really vary. Mm. How much we can mask, which is how much we can fake a more neurotypical personality, really varies. Some people cannot do that at all. And how much assistance we need and what kind of assistance we need really varies. So I don't need help communicating usually, but I need help remembering to eat, for example. And the opposite might be the case for someone else, or someone might need help with literally everything. And so, yeah, it's a very wide range of how that disability looks and how the person interacts with the world.
How did you know that you were autistic? As you said, it can be confusing, right? Because there's certain traits that everyone has that, you know, one off could be labeled as being autistic. So how did you understand that you were autistic?
It was all set into motion for me when a relative of mine got diagnosed. So I was an adult. I was in my mid-20s before I found out I was autistic. And I was struggling in life, but I did not have a name for why that was. I just knew I had trouble making friends. I had trouble with like job interviews or getting along with people at work. I was very exhausted by work and peopling. And then a cousin of mine who had gone away to college and was really struggling got diagnosed. And he kind of pulled me aside at a family function. And I should mention, I have a PhD in psychology at this point. So you'd think I would know something about autism, but I really didn't. Hmm. And he pulls me aside and he says, have you noticed, you know, I found out I'm autistic. Have you noticed like our grandpa has these traits and you know, he can't tell when people don't want to hear him telling the same story over and over again. And like, we have people in our family who are really rigid about these routines. Like, it seems like maybe autism kind of runs in the family. And I was like completely baffled because all I knew about autism at that point was the stereotype of a little 3-year-old boy playing with trains, not talking to anybody. That was the only image. Even with a PhD in psychology, I never had been taught anything other than that about autism. Mm. And so then I started really diving more into the research and talking to more autistic people and going to autistic kind of community spaces and seeking that out for myself. And once I learned what autism actually was, I realized, oh my God, this explains almost everything that's been difficult in my life up to this point. And it changed everything.
Now, a part of this, as you said, you self-diagnosed yourself as autistic. I'm wondering, did you have the skills to do that because you had a psychology degree, or how did that come about? Because, you know, one of the things that is a challenge in determining is the really complicated, really expensive, really, depending on where you live, hard to get test that provides a lot of barriers to people being able to, you know, officially be able to be diagnosed as autistic. So I'm wondering, how were you able to do that? And can you talk a little bit about the challenges around diagnosis with these tests?
Yeah, you're exactly right. And everyone listening should know that seeking out an autism diagnosis, especially as an adult, is really, really difficult. All of the assessment tools are designed for children. Even if you come in as an adult, you will be given tests that are things like being given a picture book with drawings of frogs in them and being asked to tell a story about what's in that picture book. Like, very infantilizing tests, because the lens through which psychiatry sees autism is still that 3-year-old boy, usually 3-year-old white gender-conforming boy who's obsessed with trains kind of stereotype. People get turned away from an autism assessment for things as simple as making eye contact, being polite. For women, things like if you have a boyfriend, sometimes you'll just be turned away because you're clearly coping well if you have relationships. Mm. I've heard so many horror stories from women autistics who are just told, oh, women can't be autistic. By their autism assessor, they're told things like that. And then for Black and brown autistics, a lot of them get some other kind of diagnosis instead that's way more stigmatizing, like, oh no, you're not autistic, you're a narcissist, or you're oppositionally defiant. All of these like really negative diagnoses get pinned on them. And that's on top of the fact that it's usually not covered by insurance for adults. It can cost anywhere from $3,000 to $5,000 and so on.
Wow.
Yeah. So there's very real barriers there. And that's part of the reason why the community really supports self-diagnosis, recognizing those barriers and biases. But I think the other reason too, and this comes to my kind of self-realization journey, is that if we don't see autism as a pathology, as something wrong with someone, then we don't necessarily need to believe that it needs to be diagnosed, right? Like, I also self-diagnosed my transness, you know? Like, that used to be a mental illness that you had to go to a psychiatrist and have them rubber stamp you being trans. Mm-hmm. No matter what you felt, like, you had to prove it to them that it was real. Mm-hmm. And I think we're on the exact same path now with autism, where we realize that that's not how it works. That by being in community with other autistic people, seeing yourself reflected, relating to people's experiences, figuring out what works for you and what accommodations you need, that's how you figure out who you are, in almost the exact same way that you figure out that you're trans by trying different ways of presenting yourself and talking to people and just living that life, not from a psychiatrist deciding it for you.
I want to talk a little bit about what you touched upon, which was the infantilization of people who have autism that came up in the discussion about the tests, right? In the way that people are either, you know, dismissed or minimized in the process. Oh, well, you know, this doesn't really impact you because you have X, right? Which is the person imposing kind of their lens and judgment in a hierarchical way on the other person. Talk a little bit about what that is and what it means, right? Why this infantilization? Is that something that's just rampant across psychology and psychiatry for all what we would deem to say as disabilities? Or is there something in particular about autism that is different?
I think it really is rampant in the fields. I think it's kind of built into how the medical and psychiatric systems approach the people that they see themselves as curing or caring for. When we really look back on where a lot of mental illness labels came from, it was all about how do we categorize people who are criminal? How do we categorize people who are not fit to work? It came from, historically, this very pathologizing, very dehumanizing lens. And I think it's impossible to untangle that history. You know, historically, mental asylums and jails and debtors' prisons were all the exact same place, right? Like, if you were not following the rules of society, you were sick in some way and you were put in these like sanitariums. And so I think there's a dehumanization that gets applied to anybody who doesn't conform to social rules and to psychiatry's idea of here's what a person is supposed to be. And that tends to mean you get your rights taken away and you get your humanity taken away. And so then people talk down to you, they treat you like you're incompetent, they might treat you like you're scary and dangerous, or they're going to treat you like a child, or maybe all of those things at once. And we certainly see physically disabled people have a lot of the same experience, people talking to them like they're babies, thinking that they can't be sexual, even as they're adults, not giving them full body autonomy and things like that. I think it's all connected to that dehumanization that we see in incarceration and in how people get institutionalized for nonconformity.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think once you're dehumanized, there are usually two responses that people have. You either get infantilized, so they treat you like a baby, or you are treated like a threat, right? It really is one of those two things. And I think that we see kind of the other end of the spectrum of response in terms of violence. A lot of times, for example, you know, there've been tons of instances of people who are autistic and nonverbal, and they end up being shot by the police. It really is kind of this extreme way that our society deals with those people who you say judge aren't normal and aren't human.
Yeah. What a lot of people don't realize is that 50% of Black people shot by the police in the U.S. have some kind of disability. So it's not just anti-Blackness, which is a massive problem, but ableism is a tool of furthering that.
So are these the reasons why people who are autistic mask? This is something that you've written about, but essentially find ways to hide the fact that they are different.
Yeah, there's basically, for a lot of autistic people, no choice but to mask if you have that ability to do that, right? If you're someone who is fully nonverbal, who is self-stimming, so like moving around in a very visibly autistic way all of the time, you don't necessarily have that luxury of self-protection. But virtually everyone else who's autistic, who can rein it in even a little, you know, you are ostracized if you're visibly autistic. You have the threat of violence, especially Black and brown autistics and trans femme people. You run the risk of things that really affect your material comfort, getting fired, getting kicked out of housing, getting kicked out of your home. And so people learn to repress as much of themselves as possible that gets stares or that gets people correcting you and telling you that you're not behaving appropriately. And it really becomes this kind of like lifelong state of gaslighting almost, where you just can't trust any of your natural impulses or reactions to things because you never know when it's going to cross somebody's line of that's not normal and you're going to be punished for that.
Can you talk a little bit about how masking works and then the impact of masking on people's bodies and psychology? When I had someone explain to me recently that for them, masking could include having to study every single detail on every single person's face that they interact with in order to be able to judge that person's mood and just the stress and the overwhelming nature of that. I personally can't imagine the impact of doing that, the way in which it has to dial up your nervous system anytime you're interacting with anyone because you're studying everything about them in order to be able to try to interact with them in a way that they would perceive as normal.
Yeah. Well, first of all, thank you for saying that because it is just so immensely exhausting in a way that most non-autistic people just don't get. In the literature, there's kind of two sets of skills that get used in masking as non-autistic, camouflage and compensation. So camouflage can be things like, I've learned that if I talk too much about my special interest, people think I'm childish or they think I'm a freak. So I'm going to camouflage that by pretending to know less than I do about the things that interest me or pretend to have less enthusiasm than I do. I'm going to camouflage my self-stimulatory behaviors, so like my fidgets and movements, even though those help me regulate energy, I'm going to just, you know, squeeze my hands together and like put them under the desk so that I don't get stares. All of those kinds of things are camouflage. Camouflage could also be something like, I'm going to practice facial expressions in the mirror so that I can show people how I'm feeling.
Wow.
Because the way I naturally show emotion, it doesn't register to other people. They think I'm very like flat. And then compensation is finding all kinds of little corner cuts and hacks and tricks to help yourself make up for the fact that there are things you can't do. So exactly like the example you just gave, if I can't naturally empathize, I can't read someone's emotions, I can't feel what people are feeling, I might have to compensate for that by memorizing every little facial muscle movement I can notice and figuring out what different emotions look like on that person. Or I have one person that I interview in my book who he would plan for every work meeting by writing out example dialogue of, if this person says this, here's how I'll respond. If this person says that, here's how I'll respond. He would spend hours and hours planning for every single work meeting, all of the possible ways he thought it could go, because many of us just can't respond to conversations that are unpredictable on the fly. We just don't know what to say. And so he had to compensate in that way. So there's all kinds of things like this that we do to fit in or to at least like avoid detection. And it is immensely exhausting. We see that masking is really associated with social anxiety and depression. People who mask a lot tend to have less authentic friendships because it's all built on this performance of someone that you're not. And in its really most extreme form, we see it's linked to things like suicide ideation because it's so exhausting. And because I think if you're not living a genuine life, it's hard to want to go on like that forever for a lot of people. So it takes a really, really heavy toll for autistic people who don't have any room to actually be themselves or spaces where they don't have to wear that mask.
How do you begin to live an authentic life as an autistic person in a world that's not designed for you?
It's a lot of strategizing and building your support network and thinking about what social expectations you can let go of in a lot of ways. One of the first steps, I think, is just even reconnecting to an authentic sense of self, just for yourself. A lot of people who mask all their lives, it's similar, again, to being closeted. You almost lose a connection with who you are. So a lot of people have to do a lot of inner work first of thinking back to times in their life where they did feel connected and whole and okay. And from those memories, kind of drawing inferences about here's what is really important to me. Here's who I really am when I'm not trying to fit in. I think finding community is absolutely essential. If you're only ever around people who are applying the neurotypical expectation to you, you're going to keep seeing yourself through that lens. Mm-hmm. So finding other autistic people, finding other people who have been othered in similar ways, and just spending lots of time around them. Certainly for me and for lots of people I've interviewed for my research, that is one of the big breakthrough moments of just seeing other people, you know, rocking in their seats and realizing, hey, there's nothing wrong with that, them doing that. Like, maybe there's nothing wrong with me moving how my body actually wants to move. And it is a lot of, for many of us, building new ways of being. Most of us can't work a full-time job. So that means building a support network where you can get by on relatively little and being very interdependent. I know a lot of autistic people who live in vans and trailers or who live with a relative and provide childcare help because they know they can't work a full-time job, or just lots of autistic people who live together and kind of share the load. Mm-hmm. Lots of things like that tend to be necessary for us to really find our own families and find our own way in the world that is very, very different from, you know, the neurotypical way of life that we're all spoon-fed.
There's so much of what you just said that also applies to being trans, right, and queer in the world. Finding an alternative way to live and find support in a world that's not, you know, not built for you. And that brings me to this really third rail topic of being trans and autistic. And I'm wondering if you can just talk about the way in which there have been pseudoscientists as well as people on the right who have somehow seized on this notion that actually transness is related to or some sort of consequence of being autistic, and therefore you can't really trust when, for one, anyone says that they're trans, and if a person is autistic, you can't trust that they are saying that they are trans. And just this intense way that autism is being used to dismiss gender identity.
Yeah, there is so much fear-mongering about this going on right now. And it's really staggering that it's the basis for a lot of transphobic legislation that we see in the US and in the UK and other places. This idea that because autism and transness appear to correlate at a high degree, that means that a lot of trans people are just confused, autistic people who have been influenced online by trans people into transitioning. This idea that a lot of radical, you know, transphobic feminists and far-right hate groups kind of promote. Mm-hmm. It is true that we see a lot of overlap between these communities, right? And that's not a negative thing, because there's nothing wrong with being either trans or autistic. So two great things go well together, right? A lot of people who are trans are autistic, and lots of autistic people are trans. We do see that in the data. But when we look at the research showing things like, for example, autistic people tend to be more outspoken about injustice than non-autistic people, or we tend to be more morally consistent in research. We're more willing to sacrifice other people's opinions of us to do what we believe is right. That kind of suggests that autistic people aren't necessarily more likely to be trans. We're more likely to be out. We're used to being ostracized already, and so we're willing to say unpopular truths about how we feel and who we are. And so all of this fear-mongering about autism and transness being linked is really rooted in that dehumanization that we already talked about, of autistic people's judgment not being trusted. When really we just have so many reasons to, first of all, just out of basic respect for humanity, we should trust that judgment. But we also know from research that autistic people are highly competent, are highly morally consistent, are more likely to be whistleblowers when we see injustice. We are people who tend to tell things like they are, including the truths about ourselves. It's really unfortunate that there is all of this fear-mongering happening. I used to read a lot of the transphobic detransitioner blogs, those hate movements, just to kind of understand them. They have been planning this as a talking point for years. They've been wanting to get this out in the world. And then people like J.K. Rowling picked it up and, you know, she wrote about it on her blog about how she believed a lot of trans men are just confused autistic girls, quote unquote. Mm. And it's really caught on. And I think the only remedy is for people to stop being so afraid of autism being a threat to somebody's personhood, as well as thinking that transness is some kind of negative outcome. You know, we really have to fight both of those forces in tandem.
I mean, what you're saying, it's one of the reasons why, for example, African Americans are overrepresented when it comes to being trans. It's that same thing. You're already used to being marginalized and ostracized. You already have the courage of navigating that in this world. So to take the next step is, you know, less of a leap than it is for people who are used to conforming and to being conformed. And the other thing is that I find outrageous is that trans people are everything. Trans people are, you name it. And so, of course, trans people are also going to be autistic. It so defies logic that for me, it's personally enraging. It's because there's this idea that transness isn't incompatible with everything, right? And so consequently, if it shows up, then it's a sign that something is wrong, right? And you just have the double stigmatization when it comes to being autistic and trans. Those are two things that aren't supposed to exist at all. And so there must be a reason why they're linked. And whatever that is wrong. And, you know, the fact that, as you say, there have been all of these, like, you know, Christian nationalist pseudoscientific groups like the American College of Pediatricians who are giving legitimacy to these and feeding them to places like Fourth Wave Now and others that are disseminating them, and they get picked up as talking points and they end up in places like mainstream news, places like the New York Times. It's all enraging. Well, what has you embracing your full identity meant for you and your life?
Realizing that I was autistic and realizing that I was trans happened in tandem. They happened at the same point in my life. I was such a profoundly repressed, unhappy person before I started peeling back any of these layers. A lot of the things that are really common for people, just lots of self-harm, eating disorder, just a failure to connect with other people, just everything about who I was something I hated and felt that I needed to hide away from the world. It was not really being fully alive. It was just barely eking by a survival. And as soon as I started questioning whether I needed to meet all of the ideals that society had imposed on me. Do I need to be a cis woman? Do I need to be a neurotypical person? Once I started challenging those things, I was so much freer to figure out who I was, to connect with other people from an authentic place, to be able to take care of my body and actually see my life as something worth protecting. And it also happened that my creative life as a writer just completely flourished. It was like I was working with like half a brain before because I wasn't really alive and I wasn't taking care of myself or even nourishing myself before this. So it really is a night and day difference. You know, I went from being someone who had almost no friends or ability to connect with people because everything was so tightly restricted to just having a really vast supportive community that can take care of me and that I can take care of and a sense of purpose in life. It's always hard to talk about things being more positive because we are in such a scary time in the world, but it actually feels possible for me to move forward now because I do have, you know, a reason to be alive and a way to make a difference because I know there's so many other people that are still grappling with that kind of repression who can find a better way of being. It's everything. It's hard to even put into words. I'm just so grateful that I've got to live in a time where autistic people are finding each other online and then finding each other in person, where trans people are talking about their experiences everywhere and it's possible to find. It feels like I'm just in a completely different world than the one that I grew up in, even in like the early 2000s, truly.
Well, I think, you know, what you described is finding ways in the middle of the madness to create a space for yourself. And enough people do that, and that's how we change the world, right? So I think that that contradiction is actually the way that we change things that you're discussing. And I personally know that your writing in your book has changed people's lives dramatically and has had an incredible impact. And so I just thank you so much for everything that you've done and what you will continue to do, and the fact that you found a way to be yourself in a world that's hostile to you. It's made a big impact. Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you so much, Amara. And thank you for your work, too. I see anything that I've done as just really synthesizing everything that I got that made it possible for me to stay alive from all of the work that trans people have been doing to make it possible for us to be who we are, for us to find the language for who we are. And the same thing with the autistic community, too. It's just a credit to everything that I've gotten to learn from people who've been doing this work before.
Thank you so much. That was psychologist and author Devin Price. Thank you for joining me on the Translash podcast. Now listen all the way through to the end of the show for something extra. If you like what you heard, please go to Apple Podcasts to rate and review us. You can listen to Translash wherever you get your podcast. Check us out on the web at translash.org to sign up for our weekly newsletter. Please do that. It's amazing, and we work really hard on it. Follow us on TikTok and X and Instagram at Translash Media. Like us on Facebook and tell your friends. The Translash podcast is produced by Translash Media. The Translash team includes Oliver Ash Klein and Aubrey Calloway. Sandra Adams is our senior sound engineer and a contributing producer. Alex Geha is our social media producer, and digital strategy is handled by Daniela Capistrato. The music you heard was composed by Ben Draghi and also courtesy of ZZK Records. The Translash podcast is made possible by the support of foundations and listeners like you. So this week, I am looking forward to my continued presence, my continued participation, I guess is the better word, for a symposium in Oxford, England called the SCOLD World Forum, where they bring together leaders and thinkers from all over the world for a week in a giant confab. And it's just a great way to get to know people from around the world, because as we know, so many of the attacks on our community have global implications. Look no further than Africa, for example, most recently. It's important for us to be in community and conversation with each other. So I am looking forward to that, and you can continue to follow along on social media.